Okay, good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We are we come to you this morning in some perplexity. I have to admit that in one way, the release of the movie soundtrack this past week seems perfectly timed for the discussion of poetry and song that we had planned to have. But in a different sense, it has been uniquely inconvenient because it has completely scuppered the riddle that I wanted to do for this week. My intended riddle for this week had been to talk about the number of the actual songs from The Hobbit that are going to be integrated into the film, but now with the soundtrack released, it sort of seems like we already know that. So I can't any longer ask that question. And Trish and Dave and I have been talking, and we're kind of stumped as to figure out what else to ask. We would like to start off a little backstage talk here and see what you guys think. For
In
those of you who are new,
particular,
I think
people remember is every single thing that was sung on screen in the Lord of the Rings films on the commercial soundtrack.
Yeah, basically, what Dave is fishing for is, could we still ask it anyway? I mean, if the only two things that are listed, which are clearly songs from the book, or at least adapted from songs from the book, on the soundtrack, are the two dwarf songs from Chapter One, Far Over the Misty Mountains, Cold, of course, and also the Chip the Glasses and Crack the Plate song, though
Blunt
it is called Blunt the Knives,
the
on the soundtrack.
What?
It is. I
Yeah. Yeah, it's called Blunt
They
the
give the
Knives.
knives primary
Come
billing,
on. Where
which is
is the... Oh,
interesting.
there it is. Performed by the Dwarf Cast. I didn't even see that. Well, I'm glad they have the song.
Right.
The name is something. Come on.
And they do they do some serious Cirque du Soleil antics to it too, from what I've seen on screen.
So basically, Dave's question is essentially: Do is there any hope that something like, yeah, Billy, the one that you just mentioned, the 15 Birds and 5 Fir Trees song by the Goblins, for instance, or the Down to Goblin Town song, or of course the Tralalalali song by the Elves? Is there any chance that we will get any bit of any one of those in any form? If it doesn't appear on the soundtrack, and I'm kind of thinking, no, I don't think that we really can sort of expect that would be Yana says that all the songs that were included in the extended release of the Lord of the Rings soundtrack. So, that's what I thought too. So I don't think we can hold out enough hope for that to actually still be able to ask our riddle. I think we have the answer, unfortunately, and
Sharon says maybe as chance, and I had thought about that too. Maybe off in the, like it would be like only those of us who would recognize it would hear it in the background. But I still think it would show up in the soundtrack. And I've listened to the whole soundtrack, and trust me, there is
yeah, I think
nothing.
so too. I mean, I also suspect that, right, Sharon, that was the other thought was, well, maybe they'll just like recite. So, or not have them sung so it doesn't appear on the soundtrack, but it could still be in the film. But that's very hard for me to imagine, given the songs that we're talking about. There are six songs in The Hobbit up through Out of the Fire, Out of the Frying Pan into the Fire, and the only the four that are not included, that is, the four other than the dwarf songs, are ones that are almost impossible for me to imagine being worked in a non-musical way. I mean, there's the Tralalalali song, and could you imagine them doing a dramatic recitation of the
Oh, I still have this mental image of that scene we see where they're circling the dwarves on horses, and going tra-la-la-la-lay down in
In a really threatening manner.
the valley.
Exactly. So, I don't see that happening. And then you've got what I am counting is three separate Goblin songs. You've got the initial Down to Goblin Town song in Chapter Four. You have the 15 Birds and 5 Fir Trees song, and then you have the after that. Immediately after that, the goblins burst into a different song, which is basically a reprise of the Down, Down to Goblin Town song. That's the Burn, Burn, Tree, and Fern verse that they come out with later on. So you've got three different goblin songs and the elf song, and I just can't see how any one of those. I mean, again, if you're not going to have the goblins singing Down, Down to Goblin Town, you're certainly not going to have them chanting it or just reciting it. Now, Sharon, that's an interesting idea. And Sarah just had a similar thought. Sharon suggests, will any of the missing songs or poems be alluded to in a single line delivered on screen for Tolkien geeks to recognize? So even if we don't have them, are we going to get any kind of nod to them? And Sarah, at the same time, just said similar. You know, will tra-la-la-lally ever be uttered by anybody in any context in the film?
So Dave, we have our conundrum for when we do the digest on this episode.
I was planning on doing something like that for the conundrum. It was going to be the tra-la-la-lally song or the five fir trees song. Maybe that's something we can work with. The how many of the songs will make their way onto screen in some form or fashion?
Right. Right, because that we could include. Sharon, I was thinking the same thing. Sharon just added that an orc could growl 15 birds and 5 fir trees, you know, without actually singing the song.
Which, that's true.
I mean, that certainly is. That certainly is the kind of adaptive choice that I can certainly imagine them making.
In the Down to Goblin Town, I mean, Billy kind of wrote something and made me think they could do it like a marching chant,
which is in the book. It's clearly a marching song. I say clearly from the rhythm of it, it's clearly a marching song.
So it may be recited, you know, as a hup-to kind of thing, as opposed to music.
Possibly. It's still hard for me to imagine, but possibly. I mean, I'm just trying to imagine, you know, like Ugluk from the Lord of the Rings films, you know, somebody in a costume like that saying, you know, snap, crack, the black, crack. You know, I have a hard time with that. Because it would sound really silly.
I'm glad we're recording this, because now we're anticipating all of the great discussion that we could be having on the episode.
Yes, that's true.
So I submit that the fact that we're sitting here discussing this is evidence that this could actually be a good question.
Right.
Yes. Okay. All right. Dave always brings you back to earth.
That's true. Okay, so with the adaptation suggested by Sharon and others, if we think of it in terms of adaptation, it writ large rather than simply incorporation as songs.
So the riddle would then be how many? Is it still quantitative?
Let's do either a how many, like a quantitative, or if we think it's appropriate, multiple select. Choose all of the ones that you think will be part of the song. No, actually, that'll look terrible in the grid. Okay.
We couldn't really grid that.
No. All right. So quantitative, I guess.
Quantitative is simplest.
So
how many of the songs
will be referred to in some way, shall we say, or shall will be included in some form?
Or could we do something like how will they be incorporated? So we could do so, like the answer, the very pessimistic answer would be, the only songs included on screen will be the ones that we've seen named in the soundtrack list, and the rest will not be a part of the film. The next one would be they will be referred to with Easter egg lines or whatever,
right.
just to satisfy the purists. They're, you know, with a single line or something. The slightly more optimistic answer would be the significant portions of the songs will be recited on screen, but perhaps not to music, and perhaps in an unusual way as a part of dialogue. And then we can even, just for the heck of it, we can include a delusional option.
Right, the desperate holdout version.
Yeah,
yes.
Despite the evidence, I firmly believe that these songs will make their way onto the screen.
Right, and that would be A. I would put them in exactly the opposite order of how you recited them, so that A would be the, yes, all 6 songs will be sung during the course of the films. Yep. Okay. Good. Done.
So, Dave, you can visit I'm writing it up now, but you can fix it.
Yeah, I'll fix it as we start the episode. Then.
Oh, hey, and Trish, we have a chat window available now, right?
Oh, we do. Yes, on the Riddles in the Dark page on the Mythgard Institute website, Mythgard.org. I will do that. Yeah, Dave, I'm leaving you alone with this riddle. Yeah. Don't screw it up.
All right. So what do you say we officially begin?
All right. Let us officially begin.
Yes, so I will do that.
Let me start the fun dance of getting the radio broadcast going. Okay.
Okay. And while he's doing that, Yana, I don't count. Home is behind. The question is only about the songs from the original Hobbit. So of the six songs that are in the first six chapters of the published Hobbit, what of those are going to be adapted specifically be the framework of the question? So that means, for instance, I mean, if they were to incorporate other songs, like the other references they have to other Lord of the Rings songs wouldn't count.
All right, we're ready whenever you guys are.
By the way, I can't find the chat thingy, so if you don't hear from me, that means I can't find it. Yeah, it's not there right now. All right. So anyway, I'll keep messing with it.
I'm going to count us down, and then I'll intro us. So, 3, 2, 1.
Oh, what are you doing, and where are you going? Your ponies need shoeing, the river is flowing. Oh, tra-la-la-la-ly, here down. Where are you going with beards all a-wagging? No knowing what brings Mr. Baggins and Balin and Dwallin in June in the valley. Ha ha. Oh, will you be staying or will you be flying? Your ponies are straying, the daylight is dying. To fly would be folly, to stay would be jolly. Tra-lil-lil-lil-lolly, ha-ha! What are you doing, and where are you going? Ponies need chewing, the river is flowing. Oh, tra-la-la-lally, here down in the valley. Ha-ha.
And welcome back to another episode of Riddles in the Dark, brought to you by the Mythgard Institute and Middle Earth Network Radio and a variety of other organizations, including the Tolkien Professor, published author, and audiobook recorder. And we are back after a long, I think a relatively lengthy break, and we're trying to get in as many episodes and riddles and as much discussion as we can before the film comes out in like just under a month now, I think. So we have a ton of stuff to discuss today. We're doing the one of the most hotly anticipated topics of all the topics that we said that we were going to do, songs and poems. So without further ado, let me introduce the team today. I am your co-host, Dave Kale, and with me, as always, is the Tolkien Professor, Professor Corey Olson, and also Trish Lambert. Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Okay. So, yes, we had been wanting to talk about the songs and poems for quite a while, and of course, as it happens, This week, leading up to this episode, they went and released the soundtrack of the film. So that is, well, either fortuitously or infortuitously timed, depending on your point of view, because we learned a lot about the songs and music just before we were about to speculate about it. Let me start off, though, by kind of talking a little bit about sort of what is interesting about this, because it's not, you know, some people might consider it like the sort of the height of purism to think, you know, to go through The Hobbit and think about these, you know, these often kind of silly little songs that are included in the book and be sort of hoping that those songs are going to make their way onto the film. And I just wanted to talk for a little bit about the songs in The Hobbit themselves, because, of course, you know, as anybody knows who listens to my podcast, or certainly anybody knows who's read my book, I love the songs and spend a lot of time with the songs. Yeah, it's true. Believe it or not, I'm interested in the poetry. So, yeah, basically, one of the things that I really set out to do in my book, one of the things that I felt that really nobody had done with The Hobbit, was kind of take the songs seriously and really look at them carefully and think about them. And I think that the songs in The Hobbit, you know, one of my main contentions is that they are very interesting, that they are very intricate, and that they are extremely thoughtful, even the really silly ones, and that Tolkien is really doing a whole lot of work in those songs. Even the songs like Tra-la-la-lally, which just seem really silly and drive people crazy. So I want to just talk for a second about the kind of work that I think that Tolkien does in those, because I'm going to be interested. I will be, having thought as much as I have about the songs in The Hobbit, I will be very interested to see not just whether they're included or to what extent they're included, but exactly what kind of work they're made to do in the film version, and how thoughtful they are, that is, you know, Jackson and Boyens and team, are about the role that those songs play in the story. One of the clearest illustrations of this is the major dwarf song in chapter one. One of the lines that really jumps out at me about this is the dwarves sing their song, and this comes without sort of preamble. That is, we're not given any introduction to this. They're just having the unexpected party is going on, and then, you know, they call for the instruments and they start playing music, and then Bilbo tells us a part. You know, we get what we are told is only a portion of the song that they sing, and we get Bilbo's reaction to it. So, you know, we're not given any cues, therefore, about what is being accomplished, what's happening in the song, why we're being told this song in the first place. It's just kind of atmosphere, and it seems to be. And it really kind of puts Bilbo in the dwarvish frame of mind. But later on, when Bilbo says, you know, they're talking about setting off on the adventure, and Bilbo says, well, I would like somebody to explain what it's all about. You know, he's saying, look, nobody's even said where we're going or what we're doing. And Thorin responds to that by saying, well, didn't you hear our song? Right? You know, in other words, I've already done this exposition for you, Bilbo, but I did this exposition in poetry, not in prose. And that actually is, and of course, Bilbo insists on having it laid out all plain and clear. He wants to hear the prose version, and so Thorin gives him the prose version. And this actually is a pattern that I think that we can see happening a lot in The Hobbit, where Tolkien does a lot of the work of exposition. He does a lot of backstory. He does a lot of character building not only of individual people, but of entire races and nations through the songs. And often that is, as it is in chapter one, followed up by some prose exposition, just as Thorin gives us the prose version of the history of the Lonely Mountain and the attack of Smaug following the song. So too, we get, for instance, an introduction to goblins and what goblins are like in the Goblin Town song. If we listen to that carefully, we learn a great deal about the goblins and goblin culture and what their plans are for the dwarves and the hobbit and what their nature is like. And we learn a lot about them from that song. And then on the next page, the narrator gives us some prose explanation of what goblins are like, but we've already heard it. You know, we could say like Thorin, you know, well, wait, but you know, or the narrator could have said, well, didn't you hear the song? You don't really need me to explain to you about goblins now. But he does. And that tends to be the pattern. The pattern is he'll do the poem first, and then he'll give the prose exposition. It's sort of, he sets us up for it, and then he spells it out. And I think that that's a really important pattern in The Hobbit, because the poetic effect, if you actually do read the poems and you think about the poems, they will have an effect. You won't necessarily gain all the prose information that you get from the narrated accounts. I mean, goodness knows there are many details, for instance, of the attack of Smaug on the Lonely Mountain that we do get from the prose version that we don't get from the poem, and we wouldn't have been able to guess from the poem. But of course, there's a great deal of stuff that we get from the poem that we don't get from the prose. And what it is exactly that, much less tangible, much less fact-based, much more evocative and emotional kind of experience, just as Bilbo has that experience of seeing the desire of the hearts of feeling, rather, the desire of the hearts of dwarves when he hears the dwarf song. So too, we also can have that experience. We can have a kind of visceral understanding of the goblins and what they're like from this, you know, snap, clap, the black crack song. That is far more powerful in its way than we get from listening to them talk, hearing the narrator talk about them. But so we've been set up for it. First, as I say, I think the order is very significant and very deliberate on Tolkien's part. First, he gives us the poetry and leaves us with these impressions. He builds these images in our minds and these sort of emotional constructions that he shows us. He shows us the hearts of the dwarves. He shows us the hearts of the goblins. And then he tells us about them, so that when we hear about them, we're already prepared. When we hear the narration, the prose narration of the story of the attack of Smaug on Erebor, though it's not called that in Chapter 1 of The Hobbit, we already know the sort of the emotional significance of that moment. We are ready sort of emotionally, though emotional isn't quite the right word, to fill the gaps and to give to the prose, to the bald, comparatively bald prose account, a kind of significance that it clearly has to the characters. And as I say, I think that we get this kind of pattern in more than one place. This is the same thing that we get from the elves as well. This is one of the effects of the Tralalalali song. We get that before we get anything else about the elves. It is our first impression of the elves. And it is immediately informed. We are supposed to, and this is, I think, what people have so much of a hard time with the Tralalalali song, is that it seems dissonant with what comes after. Whereas with the dwarves and the goblins, say, the two things seem to go more obviously together. We hear about the passion of the dwarves for their craftsmanship, and we get these horrific images of the attack of Smaug, and this sense of the rage and the grief of the dwarves in looking back on it. We get all that stuff in the song, and then we get a description of what happens, and we're ready to go back to the stuff that we learned, the less sort of definable stuff that we learned from the, you know, impressions we got from the song, and are ready to apply it, and it fits well with the prose account that we get. Well, when we come to Rivendell, we get the elf song, which sounds absurd. Ridiculous is the narrator's word to describe it, so Tolkien is not making any attempt. I mean, he has himself labeled it a ridiculous song, so that reaction doesn't seem inappropriate. It sounds ridiculous to us. And then the prose account that comes after, the thing that the song seems to be setting us up for, is the description of Elrond, the references to the fall of Gondolin that we get. In fact, the elves seem to be anything but frivolous once we get past the song. Once we get past those elves that are singing at the river, and we actually meet Elrond and we're in conversation with Elrond, the elves never look frivolous again throughout the whole rest of Chapter 3. So the combination of those two things, the combination of the impressions that we get from the elf song with the actual prose description of what happens in the interactions we have with Elrond and the rest of the residents of Rivendell, doesn't really seem to fit together. And that's why I think people have a really hard time with that song. So, but I think it still does work. I don't think it's a deviation from the pattern. I think it still is the same pattern. But rather, what he's trying to get us to do there is to combine two things which don't seem to fit very obviously together. He wants to juxtapose. He seems to be attempting to juxtapose this kind of merriment and fun and joyfulness, which is so extreme as to sound ridiculous to the much, much more serious dwarves, and even Bilbo, who still takes himself, perhaps not quite as seriously as Thorin takes himself, but still apparently much more seriously than the elves of Rivendell take him, were to combine those kinds of things that we see in the song with the high seriousness and even tragedy of the elves as we're introduced to them when we get there. And that dissonance, I think, is part of what Tolkien is trying to do. I mean, I argue in my book that he's trying to do this, and it just doesn't really work that well. That is, I don't think he's perfectly successful in achieving this, and I think that's why the elf song and the whole depiction of the elves of Rivendell seems to fall flat for people, because I think it didn't quite work. But this is what it seems to me that he's trying to do. I think what he's establishing is something kind of like a paradox. Because the elves are beyond our experience, are beyond human comprehension. They don't, you know, to get a glimpse of the desire of the hearts of elves is to come into contact with something much more alien, I think. And that's what he's trying to do, I suspect. Anyway, this is my description of how I understand the songs to be functioning in the Hobbit book, and why I think they're so important, and why I think they serve to make the story so much more powerful if you pay attention to them. So that then leads me to the question of how these songs are going to be adapted, and why I think it's an important question. I don't even know, for instance, even the most basic question, how much of this kind of thing are the adapters thinking about? You know, what is their view of the songs? Are they seeing the songs as anything but curiosities? Are they seeing the songs as anything but like fun interludes? There was certainly some of the songs that had a powerful emotional impact in The Lord of the Rings. I'm not trying to say that all songs in the films are frivolous, but are they doing, you know, what kind of thinking are they doing? What kind of role do they see songs and verse playing in the Hobbit film, if any? And so that's for me personally, that's kind of where I start off in asking this question about the films and trying to think about how they're going to incorporate stuff into the movies. Okay, so I Fantastic. Will end lecture mode now. I've actually just been thinking about this again. As Dave mentioned, just on the reason we're having our broadcast on Thursday instead of Tuesday this week is that I was in the recording studio all morning and afternoon on Tuesday, recording the unabridged version of my book for the audiobook version.
Were so you I've just been thinking about this. It like to us?
Yeah, well, not the book, but yeah, I mean, but this stuff is all really fresh in my mind.
Are you
because
plagiarizing
I just...
yourself?
I'm totally plagiarizing myself. I just reread in full chapters 1 through 4 of my book the day before yesterday. So that whole pattern is really fresh in my mind. Yeah, and not only fresh in my mind, like it in some ways even fresher than right after I wrote it, because when I was in the process of writing, I rarely sat down and read through the first four chapters at a time in one sitting. So I have a better perspective on it now than before. Dave, go ahead.
So you laid out a very good sort of argument for the importance of the songs to the book and why people should, as they're reading through the Hobbit, why they should actually read through the songs, maybe even read them out loud and not just skip over them. And I'm certainly convinced, and I will say that it's largely under your influence that in subsequent readings of The Hobbit in the last few years that I actually slow down and pay more attention to the songs than I have in the past.
Yes.
So how do we want to start our discussion of these? So obviously they're important. That of course by no means it indicates that they should be included in the film. How do we want to start our discussion about how they might make their way into the film? Should we start with talking about how songs were handled in the the movies, or should we maybe just sort of? The other thing that I definitely want to cover is the handling of the songs in Rankin Bass. So
yes. Yes, I want to talk about that too, because – well, actually, let me start with that, because I will say that the songs in the Rankin Bass, that is, in my mind, no question, head and shoulders, the best aspect of that entire movie.
I completely
they
agree.
Do every single bloody song. I don't think they leave out one. I think they do all of them. I mean, did they? Trish went. Trish is in my Hobbit class right now at Mythgard, where we're just talking about the film this week. So I know that she and I have both watched the Rankin Bass film very recently. Trish, did you notice any that were left out?
No, they included all of them.
There's one. Just thought of one. They left out the. Back to the Lands You Once Did Know song for the Barrels. But that's because they did do the Heave Ho Splash Plump
that's
song.
That's right.
You know, so they only did one instead of both of the Elf Barrel songs. But still, come on. I mean, you got to give them credit for that even.
Now, it did occur to me as I was watching it, and I marveled as I watched the movie, yes, that they included all that. But aren't they actually are. Weren't Rankin and Bass actually lyricists? I mean, songwriters and lyricists anyway. I mean, that's kind of where they came from, right?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, it's...
I mean, I don't want to spoil the effect here, but I mean, I thought to myself, well, yeah, I guess they would keep them in because that's kind of where they come from.
Yeah, and it seems, I mean, the film is actually billed as, you know, a musical presentation.
As a musical,
because
right.
Because it is
right,
so
right.
Full of the music.
For all of the things I have to say about the Rankin Bass, I will say that the songs and inclusion of the songs is a definite thumbs up for me.
Yeah, yeah. Now there are actually. I just thought of another one. They didn't do the spider songs. They didn't do Old Fat Spider Sitting in a Tree, or either one of. Yeah. Instead, they make and I just laughed out loud when I got to this part of the movie this past week. They made Lazy Lob and Addercop into a battle cry that Bilbo shouts out as he charges with Sting into battle. He's like, Lazy Lob.
but wait, awesome. I'm looking at the soundtrack list. They have Old Fat Spider listed. What did they
wait for the Rankin
on the Rankin Bass?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, no, that's they do. There's music going on.
Oh,
but
there's
they don't
oh, it's just the music.
The,
oh, it's just the
it's
music.
Just the music that yeah. they call that. Yeah, but again, even that you see shows their sensitivity to it. Like there's even the songs that they don't. Do the actual words of they're still conscious of, you know, I mean they were still thinking about the Old Fat Spider song in order to name the
right,
background
right.
music for the spiders that
now I have to share this with our listeners. Okay, I had the privilege of actually watching Corey watching segments of the Rankin Bass movie on Monday night, and I have to tell you that the look on his face was one of great affection.
Did you watch this in class?
You have great affection for this movie. We watched pieces of it.
Parts of it, yeah. We did clips. Now there are some,
and it was
that
really,
really fun.
Fun to watch Corey. There were a couple times you raised your eyebrow, but mostly you were very affectionate. It was a very affectionate look on your face, which I thought
yes.
was nice.
Yes, no, it's fun. It's fun. Now the thing that I find that I find most difficult to forgive about the Rankin Bass film is the enormously peculiar visual decisions that they made. You know what I mean? Like, why
yes,
on earth?
Yes,
me, like
why on earth
frog
the wood elves the way that they did? Like, yes,
frog golem.
Yes.
And the wood elves.
Yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
You got an Elven King that looks like looks like the Grinch's cousin.
Yeah, he does. And the actor who plays Bilbo, I mean, I'm sorry, but he appears to have about the range of a porcelain doll. I mean, Bilbo speaks in exactly the same tone of voice in every situation, no matter what. In his drawing room, to Smaug, to Gollum. I mean, like, nothing phases. It's like the most implacable Bilbo.
Yeah,
it's true.
And that drives me bananas. But anyway, you know, so I mean, there are things that I dislike about it. And visual decisions. Why does Smaug have hair? I don't understand. My Smaug has whiskers and a whole ruff of fur down his back. It just it's it I don't get
it's perplexing
it.
And Elrond's freaky thing around his head is really
yes,
odd.
Yes, his like little
wood
star
elves in general
thing. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and Elrond, you know, Elrond's an elf, but he doesn't look anything like, you know, anyway.
Yeah. But the songs.
Thinking about how the songs are used, for instance, in the Rankin-Bass version, they do some really thoughtful things. It's not just that they include them sort of slavishly, and I actually do think one of the greatest weaknesses of the Rankin-Bass screenplay as a whole is the fact that that they are too slavish. I was kind of making this argument in class on Monday that I think that the film would have been better served by cutting the Battle of Five Armies than
doing it
in the perfunctory way that they did it. And they contrived instead they did it, but they contrived to make it really boring and stupid and anticlimactic. So I think they would have been better off just cutting out the Battle of Five Armies entirely and having Bilbo going home after the death of Smaug. I think they would have done less violence to the book, actually, had they just done that than as they did in keeping it. But anyway.
It could be worse. It's not as bad as what Ralph Bakshi did.
But see, there again also, that's another adaptation which... again, the visuals in Ralph Bakshi are even less... understandable. I mean, like, why? Who on earth? Like, why is Boromir a Viking? Anyway, but it's fine. Like, I'm over. Why is Boromir a Viking and why is Treebeard a carrot? Those are the two things that I will never understand. But there again, I mean, like the actual script of the Bakshi version is like a pastiche of quotations. I mean, there are very few lines. Which are, I mean, almost all of it is adapted from the text directly. That was Peter Beagle's whole approach to the Bakshi.
As long as we're taking turns lodging complaints against these old adaptations, the one I have for Ralph Bakshi is why are all the Ringwraiths' legs broken, so that they can't walk normal.
Yes, and I don't understand the whole like low speed chase flight to the Ford thing. I don't understand, but anyway,
the songs,
the songs. Digressing. So the songs, in the Rankin-Bass version, they do some interesting things. In fact, there's even one place that I found interesting. In fact, Trish, this is a spoiler because I plan to talk about this in class tonight. When Bilbo falls asleep and has his dream right in the Goblin Cave, right before they're captured, the Rankin-Bass version actually does his dream. They do a version of his dream. And what they have him, what happens in his dream, he dreams a little reprise of the Chip the Glasses and Crack the Plates song. And I find that really fascinating. I think that's a brilliant move that we see, you know, him in this moment, especially in the way that they do it in such an accelerated way in the film, of course. You know, we have this, that song is in fact very, very similar to the Goblin song that the Goblins are just going to do. So he has this this dream about the dwarves invading and messing up his house and singing their sort of threatening song. And that is sort of the warning flash that he is given for the goblins who are about to come in. I think the way that they do it is really cool and really interesting. Of course, that's not exactly done that way in the book. But it seems to me very much in the spirit, really a very careful reading of both the Goblin Town song and the Chip the Glasses song, I thought. So the Rankin-Bass film does very, very interesting things with the songs. As I say, it is my favorite part. There are some things that they do that are a little bit puzzling. Like, for instance, they do Bilbo's Roads Go Ever, Ever On song. But they insert it not at the end when he's coming home, which is where we get it in the book, but they put it when Bilbo is going on the path through Mirkwood. When they go out into Mirkwood and they're on the path, that's when we get the Roads Go Ever, Ever On song, with a lot of the same lines and the same images, which placed in that different context sound very strange and very interesting. I think there's a lot I think that could be said with what they're doing with the Roads Go Ever, Ever On song. They don't do the last bit of it, you know, like the, you know, the, the eyes that fire and sword have seen and horror in the halls of stone look again on Meadow's Green. I mean, that's the explicitly returning home part of it, and so they cut that bit out because it's not returning home in the film. But anyway, it is the one thing that I am willing to give most credit to Rankin and Bass for, and that is not only in their inclusion, their choice to include the songs, but in their thoughtfulness about the songs. And I think that there are some places where they're even doing other things which are totally unrelated to how the songs are acting in the book, but I actually think that they're using the songs convey some other things that they don't say in prose.
What about their choice to have the goblins utilize synthesizers and to sing their to turn their songs into disco tracks?
But that's very insidious, right? I mean, what says evil more plainly, more
manifestly
than disco tracks?
I do find those songs the goblin songs, and that includes the orc song from the Return of the King adaptation.
Where there's a whip, there's a way.
Yes.
That greatest classic of all Tolkien adaptation.
Yes.
Oh,
I find those to be the catchiest and most hummable songs. Like I'm ashamed to admit that there will be just random occasions where I will start humming that as I'm going about my day.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, that song is iconic. I mean, absolutely.
Now I do want to, you know, I kind of sent you a garbled version of this, Corey, and I'm still worried that I didn't express myself very well with this, but you know, one of the things that I was saying is putting this movie in context of its time and its medium, I think is very useful. You know, children's animated features, I mean, Disney started this, you know, the musicals, that whole thing with having songs be in the children's animated features, it kind of been started by Disney. So on this one hand, you know, that kind of set the tone for including all these songs. And then also the fact that it was, you know, a TV movie as opposed to a screen movie. The network, and 77 was a time when the parents lobby for, I think this explains our deflating Great Goblin, you know, the anti-violence and all that stuff, very strong. So I actually think, you're right, you know, you said about the close reading. I mean, I think Rankin and Bass and their writers really did try to do their best with this, but I think they were hemmed in a lot by censors and parent lobbies and the network and whatnot. So I think that explains some of the strange things we might see.
Yeah, that does seem, I mean, I don't know enough about, you know, TV network politics to be able to sort of comment on that, but it makes sense to me. I mean, I can certainly believe it. And certainly, as you say, there are, you know, you can do stuff in a film which you might then have to
rated R,
but you can still do it. No one's going to stop you doing it.
Yeah.
Whereas the public TV networks are rigid.
Right, control. Right. Right. So anyway, I mean, that was just an interesting thing to put it in. I mean, I think today the parents' lobby isn't anywhere near as strong as it was, you know, back in those days. And of course, Jackson, if you compare Jackson's movie, I think he's got a lot more elbow room, even as a movie, you know, than somebody would have had like in the 70s if they tried to do the movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh,
so
certainly,
But now thinking about this then would then lead me to the question of the songs in the Lord of the Rings films. And on the one hand, on the one hand, that would seem to be obviously a logical thing to do. Like, let's look at how Peter Jackson and team handled the handled songs in that film, both songs that they adapted from Tolkien and songs that they made up themselves. And one difficulty that I have with it is that I don't think that looking at what they did in The Lord of the Rings gives us necessarily a fair basis for evaluation for two reasons. First of all, there is not as much poetry. The density of poetry is much less in The Lord of the Rings than it is in The Hobbit.
And it doesn't appear to play the same role either, right?
Exactly. No, it doesn't. And it's also less musical. You're more likely to get recited stanzas, things which are being chanted, not sung.
Despite Robert Inglis's valiant efforts.
Right, right. Yeah, though he does chant some of them. He doesn't sing them all.
That's true.
But yeah, I mean, it's difficult. And the whole, yeah, as I say, the way that the songs work in The Hobbit just is different from the way that the songs work in The Lord of the Rings. And so, you know, I will be interested to see if they have a different kind of, if they have a different kind of approach to those songs.
How would you say that that they are, because it is obvious that they're different. What would you say? Like, the songs seem to play kind of almost an integral role in The Hobbit, whereas in Lord of the Rings, they seem more like just either they have like a plot element. For example, the elves songs in Lothlorien about Gandalf after his death,
right.
And then even Sam's song. So sometimes they have plot elements. But otherwise, it just seems to kind of be adding kind of color, like the Hobbit walking songs or whatever. Whereas in The Hobbit, they really seem actually significant.
Yeah, and I think that the thing that I would point to, and you know, any generalization like this is going to be really crude inevitably, but one thing that I would say is that in general, the songs in The Lord of the Rings seem to be much more interested in... I want to say atmosphere, but I don't think that's quite the right word. I also want to say scenery, but that's not quite right either. But let me explain what I mean by that. I explained about how in the Hobbit, I feel that the songs play an important role, sometimes even in advancing the plot, but at the very least in our understanding of the story and of the characters in it. The songs seem to work primarily in The Lord of the Rings as a way for us, basically as ways in which Tolkien is making the world that he is walking us through more real. So just let me cite a couple examples of this. As you said, the Hobbit walking songs at the beginning, right? When we get the walking song, the bath song, you know, we are being given glimpses, even the sort of adventure song that we get, the one that Bilbo made up right after they set out. Those songs show us not only Hobbit culture, but they show us the kind of like Bilbo Baggins centered Hobbit counterculture that has grown up around Bilbo and Frodo in the last, you know, 60 years. When we get to Tom Bombadil, of course, you know, his songs aren't important to the plot of the overall plot of the story, but they are really important ways for us to understand him and who he is and what that interlude is about. When we get to, when we get to Rohan and the random verse, the one which is based on The Wanderer, you know, where is the horse and the rider song that Aragorn recites. There's no function of that song plot-wise other than, I mean, what it is explicitly designed to do for the benefit of Legolas and Gimli primarily, and of course the readers as well, is to give us, like, here's some local color on the Rohirrim. You know, here is an idea of what to expect. And so it's not that I think that those songs aren't meaningful, because they are. I mean, you could say that it functions like the songs in The Hobbit, in that just as we learn a very great deal about the goblins by listening to their song before we really meet them or hear anything about them, so too we learn a whole lot about the Rohirrim from that song, which Aragorn recites before we get into the Golden Hall, and it helps to set up what we see going on there and helps us to understand the point of view of the Rohirrim. But it's still, but I don't think it's not quite as closely tied to the story as it's developing. I mean, I'm not saying that I think that sort of filling out the world that Tolkien has created is, you know, an unimportant thing or is not really significant, because I think it's very significant. But most of the songs seem to have that kind of a function, less directly connected with the story, itself, and more just about characters and background. Again, that's a generalization, but that would be my answer to what's the difference between the Hobbit and Lord of the Rings song.
Interesting.
I mean, in some ways it does similar work, but I do think it's less tied up in the story, that he expects it, he's leaning on them less, I guess. I mean, if you don't pay attention to that song, you don't miss much. I mean, seriously, like, not that you don't get much from that song. I'm thinking of the Rohirrim song there, Where's the Horse and the Rider song.
No, but it's not, as opposed to the dwarf song at the start of The Hobbit, where it's like, if you didn't pay attention to that, you, like Bilbo, now have no idea what's going on.
Exactly. That's precisely the difference. Whereas, and it's the same thing like with the wood elves. Think about what we learn about the wood elves. You know, I mean, The Hobbit tells us almost nothing about the wood elves. I mean, we get a brief interaction with them, which is very unflattering, in the throne room of the Elven King. But other than that, what else do we know about them? What are wood elves like? What is their culture like? You know, are they kind? Are they friendly? What are they like? Well, what we get from them is their songs. We learn more about them from the Beryl songs, silly as those Beryl songs are, than we learn about them in almost any other way. Lord of the Rings, those kinds of gaps aren't left. We learn a lot about Gollum from listening to his expanded fish song, right? You know, when he does his little reprise of the fish riddle and adds verses to it. We learn a lot about him if we listen to that, but it's not like we're not going to get that information if we don't. You know, it's less essential to understanding it. And some of the Hobbit songs work that way too. If we don't pay attention to the Goblin song, well, we'll still learn about goblins on the next page. It's not like we'll be completely at a loss. So sometimes Tolkien is still working that way there too. But I feel that the songs in the Hobbit have a little bit more riding on them in that way. Or to take another example, the prophecies The prophecies of what will happen when the Mountain King returns, the prophecies which become the focus of the people in Lake Town and then are being alluded to again. If we don't pay attention to the song they sing in Lake Town, we're scarcely going to have any idea what they're talking about. I mean, that entire element gets introduced in the song.
Right.
And that kind of thing does not seem to me to happen quite so much in The Lord of the Rings. The songs in The Lord of the Rings are, in that way, more kind of asides.
Yeah.
Rich asides, which have a huge impact on our reception of the story if we pay attention to them. But not generally crucial to the story itself. As I said, probably an overgeneralization, but for that reason, again, it makes me wonder, are they going to be thinking about the songs differently? To what extent are, you know, the movie people going to be sort of sensitive to this? And in what way would they see this connected? Because I suspect they would see it connected to the pledge which Peter Jackson has made from the beginning that he was not going to completely leave behind the lighthearted and comical tone of the Hobbit book, that he wanted to bring in that lighthearted tone that everybody associates with the Hobbit and which is so different from The Lord of the Rings, that he wanted to preserve that and have there be a perceptible difference in the tone of these films compared to the tone of the previous films.
I'll tell you, the soundtrack sounds to me like... Matt Shaw, who's with us today, has said that he's listened to the soundtrack now multiple times, and I've only listened to it once, so he could weigh in on this. But I got to tell you, I mean, the soundtrack to me, other than the two songs, well, I mean, even the Misty Mountain song is important. It all sounds pretty Lord of the Rings-ish in the context you were just talking about. I mean, it doesn't sound frivolous. It sounds pretty heavy-duty stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that does kind of surprise me, given what you just reminded me of, which is the Jackson was saying he was going to try and keep with the lighthearted tone of the book.
There is little in the way of evidence that he's upholding that promise or he's using a very, very flexible interpretation of what that means, because I think the songs are probably like one of the single most important ways in which he would do that. Like, if he had a lot more on-screen singing, it really would feel like The Hobbit, whereas if he doesn't, it'll be hard to. But my sneaking worry, and in general, I'm very optimistic about the films and excited to see them, despite other things that we've said in the past. but I would say that my sneaking worry is that they're going to toss in a lot of slapstick humor, like Bomber sitting on the table and having it break, and then point at that and say, "See, we put humor in here, just like in The Hobbit."
Right.
And the
thing with the great goblin at the end of the trailer.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of gag.
Yeah, and it's like, I mean, okay, sure, fine, that's humor, but it's like, I hope that they. I would like to think that they understand the book well enough to know that it's not the same thing, you know. Like, fine, you're going to pass it off for the movie going public, but like for those of us who've read the book and are familiar with it, don't try to convince us that this is the same kind of humor. But
so
anyway, Corey, it would seem like the difference that you've just laid out between The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. I mean, if ever I've heard an argument for putting more songs in the film adaptation of The Hobbit, that would be it. But it looking at the soundtrack list, it's not clear that they're actually doing that.
Yeah, and I think of all of the ones, you know, I mean, as I've said from the beginning, I'm completely and utterly reconciled to not getting the Tra-la-la-lolly song. I mean, I don't.
Not me.
Expect that in any way. Mostly because, as I say, I don't think it really succeeds. I don't think it really has the effect for most readers that I suspect and believe that Tolkien was going for. But
I was kind of hoping that maybe Jackson would, you know, have Tolkien, I mean, elven children singing it or something. But
right, possibly. but anyway, you know,
the Rivendell Children's Choir.
Children's Choir with a little mortal boy, you know, with Estelle kind of stuck in the back there.
In fact, he might be the Rivendell Children's Choir. He might be the only child left.
That's right. But anyway, so I wouldn't expect that. I am going to miss the Goblin Town song. I mean, if there's no Goblin Town song, I'm going to miss it. But you know, the one thing that I would want to say is that I'm going to be very interested I still haven't gotten to listen to the soundtrack yet. I will be very interested to hear the entire Far Over the Misty Mountains song and to see it really how they do that in the film. Its use in that first trailer that we got last year was fantastic. I mean, that was like head and shoulders, I thought, the most excellent revelation about the films in that first trailer was that song and the way that song seemed to be being deployed, because I think that, again, based on what we saw, and I'm basing it still primarily on that old trailer, the way that they seemed to be using the song did strike me as somewhat similar to how the song is being used in the book. And I'll be very interested to see how they do that. And that, of course, that there's nothing, you know, there's nothing frivolous or comical about that song in the book either. And so seeing how they maintain that, even just the way in which, you know, sort of Thorin starts off singing it as if narrating, right? You know, as if like he's going to tell the story, and he tells the story by singing. And then the other dwarves all join in. I thought it works really well, and I will be, as I said, I'll be very interested to see, because I suspect that there, it sounds like that's like the thing that I pin my hopes to about the fact that they may be using the songs, you know, not simply as sort of interludes or something, but actually to be integrating it with the story in ways which might be comparable to the way the songs are used in the book.
The chat room is up. I'm just sending out the...
oh, good.
It's on the main Rules of the Dark page in on the Mythgard.org site. So if people want to go over there and chat among themselves, they can do that.
Cool. Yeah, you know, Philip points out that the Far Over the Misty Mountains song seems too long to include in its entirety in the film. I agree. I mean, it's 7 verses long, right? So, I mean, it is certainly a long song. I don't think they could do every single verse of it. But you know, they could still, I mean, they could still, what I'll be interested to see, well, actually, and those of you who have heard, because the whole song is on the soundtrack, right?
Yes.
Okay. So yes. I haven't gotten to listen to it yet, as I said, but Trish and the rest of you who have, do they do both parts of it? Like, do we get both an introduction? Because, you know, in the song, in the book, we get two things. We're talking about the desire of the hearts of dwarves. The song is kind of split in half. The first half, more than the first half, really almost the first two-thirds of the song, is focused on the dwarves, the dwarven craftsmanship, right? It's focusing on the stuff that they make and their works of hands. And then it segues at the end to a description of the coming of the dragon to the Lonely Mountain. Do we get both elements of that in the song?
Gosh, now I don't remember. Matt or somebody else who's heard it, do you guys remember if it's there?
That's what I will be interested to hear how those things are emphasized. Because, you know, when we get, you know, when we are told, again, to quote again that famous phrase from chapter 1, when we are introduced to the desire of the hearts of dwarves, by that song in the book, it's both of those things, right? We get the first primary emphasis on first try to understand, first try to relate to the relationship in general that dwarves have with their works, right? So that this is not just a question of, oh, like this is my house and you've taken it away from me and I'd quite like my house back. You know, that's not what's going on there. And, you know, this is something that I was thinking about also from that new TV trailer that they just released, the one where mm-hmm. Bilbo is doing so much of the talking, and he's talking about helping them get their homes back and how Bag End is his place and where he belongs. That I find very interesting for two reasons. Because, first of all, the element of the quest for the Lonely Mountain as homecoming by the dwarves in particular, that idea of home and, you know, the place where they belong, is an element which is very little emphasized in the book. Now, I will say that is one that does seem to come out much more later on. Thorin, in The Quest of Erebor, talks like that a great deal more than Thorin in the published Hobbit does. In the published Hobbit, the dwarves are just about the treasure. You know, like the Lonely Mountain itself is like a kind of bonus. They're not thinking primarily of reestablishing the kingdom. They're thinking primarily of regaining their treasure. That's the whole point of it. And that's what the song lingers on, the treasures and the treasures and the treasures. And then once we are given this idea of the dwarves' heart for their treasures, then we see this. Then we're prepared for the significance of the coming of the dragon. Yes, it's about the tragedy of the massacre. Yes, it's about vengeance for the people that Smaug has killed. But it also helps us to understand that's the note that the song ends on. You know, to win our harps and gold from him. You know, he, the dragon, is still sitting there, keeping our treasures, these things which mean so much to us, as we've shown. So anyway, again, that's you know what the song, you know, some of what the song accomplishes, I think, in the book.
That's
the kind
of
thing that I'm going to be listening out for when we see the film.
What do you think, Corey?
What'd you say?
Maybe they mean home is their treasure.
Right. Well, but you see, that's interesting. I mean, the comparison that Bilbo makes in the trailer that was just released, of, you know, he's like, yeah, you know, I understand your whole home thing, right? Because, you know, Bag End is my home and I belong there, and you want to go and regain your home, and I can relate to that, so I'll help you win your home. Okay, I can see that, but the dwarves' relationship with their home is very different from Bilbo's relationship with Bag End. You know, and of course it may well be, you know, in that trailer we hear almost exclusively Bilbo talking. So it may well be that we're just getting Bilbo's perspective on this, that this is how Bilbo is conceiving of it, you know, that he can understand their quest because he does not really get the whole dwarven relationship with treasure and never does really get the dwarven relationship with treasure, that the way that he understands it, he himself is longing for Bag End, and so he kind of projects onto them a comparable longing for the Lonely Mountain, you know. Maybe that's what we're getting, you know, that's how they're going to depict Bilbo's point of view, and that the dwarves are not going to necessarily have that same point of view, or that's not how we're going to be asked to understand them. But
Tidbit, Corey. Matt Shaw tells us that the Neil Finn version of the Misty Mountain song has lyrics mentioning the Arkenstone.
Yes, I've been hearing rumors about that. I think that's excellent. I will be and you know, I'd always suspected that the Arkenstone was going to make it in, because just visually speaking, I can't imagine the Weta Workshop people not wanting to do an Arkenstone. I mean, like, would they pass that up?
Are we talking about the real Arkenstone or the dwarf ring, which we're referring to as the Arkenstone?
No, I mean the real Arkenstone, like a big, wonking, shiny gem. I don't think they would have been able to pass up the opportunity.
Yeah, I agree.
And there seems to be some confusion. The Neil Finn song at the end is not the dwarf song that Tolkien wrote and that they sing in the Bag End. It starts off sounding similar to it, but it's got different lyrics. So that song is a different song from the dwarf song that Corey's been talking about.
That's an entirely novel that's similar to...
Right.
Similar to Rankin Bass's Greatest Adventure song.
Right.
Yes, The Ballad of the Hobbit. Right. Which, of course, is another thing I was talking about on Monday. That just, like, that song makes me want to... Well, no, it's not just that it makes me want to retch. It's that I find it completely incoherent, like annoyingly.
It doesn't match. Yeah, it doesn't match.
It doesn't match anything. It doesn't match itself. Yeah. One line doesn't match the next line. I mean, it is when you actually sit down and think it through in the way that I like to sit down and think through the songs and poems, it is a garbled mess. It contradicts itself from one stanza to the next. I mean, it just. Ugh.
How does it compare to the
Well, now, if you want
to
retch.
How does it compare to the Return of the King song, It's So Easy Not to Try?
Well, I don't remember. It's been a while since I've seen the Return of the King. Of course, I will never forget Where There's a Whip, There's a Way. Like that, I can still sing that song end to end, I think, but the rest of it is a little fuzzier in my mind. But
if you really want to retch, let's go with Leonard Nimoy's song about Bilbo Baggins.
Hey, the Ballad of Bilbo Baggins. That song is class compared to the Ballad of the Hobbit from the Rankin Bass version, the Glenn Yarborough thing. No way, man! I'm taking Nimoy over Yarborough 7 days a week. I mean the Bilbo Baggins song, the Nimoy song is like, you know, I mean that it doesn't get campier than that. But it's got.
Oh, I know, it's true.
But its main fault is simply its campiness. You know, at least its campiness is relatively coherent, and it's. Anyway,
no, you're right. The Yarborough song is very serious. I mean, it kind of is, I suppose, supposed to add some gravity to the story, but.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, the primary theme of the Glenn Yarborough Ballad of the Hobbit song and the Rankin Bass is. It's as I forget which one of my students it was in class on Monday characterized it as a carpe diem song, which I think is a very good description of it. You know, it's all about how like adventure lies ahead, and you know, it's you know, the future is in your hands. Are you going to break the mold of your life and step out and do something adventurous, or are you just going to let life pass you by? And that's fine. I mean, that's thematically very different from where Bilbo really is in chapter one of The Hobbit. But, you know, whatever, I can live with that. What bothers me about it when I'm talking about its incoherence is then he has verses in the same song where he's talking about dreams and dreamers, which every time I hear it, I expect it to be basically praising them, you know, being like, oh, you know, it's the dreamers. It's those who are like willing to dream big and step forth. But no, actually he's criticizing them. You know, it's like, you know, those dreamers who just sit by the window and don't do anything. And it's like, wait a second, but that's not, like, what does any of this have to do with Bilbo? Like, he's neither one of those things. And there's this
that's
whole,
true.
Like, don't
he
think.
He did not sit by the window and dream.
No, exactly. It's, I don't know, it just, like, the whole thing just does not make sense to me. I find it very annoying.
So let's talk a little bit about the songs that we know for sure are in the film, and then we've actually heard. Maybe we'll start with the.
Well, that'll
Misty
be
Mountain.
Short.
Yeah. Well, the Misty Mountain. We'll start with the Misty Mountain song, and I haven't actually listened to the Chipped Plate song yet, so I'm kind of curious to hear how that one goes.
Yeah.
Is that actually
Trish,
sung?
Tell me about that one.
Well, it is sung, and it's not on the soundtrack that we can listen to at this point because it's part of the extended edition. But there is the Denny's restaurant featurette, which I think I put in the comic book movie number 4 of the notes that I have up for you guys, or that that Dave put into our little thing here. That's got some. Scenes from when they're singing the song, and they're like throwing plates, and Keeley and Feely are doing like somersaults and catching plates on the fly.
Right. By the way, that
while
Denny's
they're singing
thing,
the song,
I think we can all agree that Denny's thing, if Tolkien was still alive today, that would have killed him.
And
they've got like plates stacked and all this kind of stuff. You mean the fact that Denny's actually did like a little featurette of it?
Oh no, just like that blatant kind of commercializing. That is the kind of stuff that would have just killed him. Like
The Gandalf the Grey gravy boat or whatever the heck.
Yes, I mean, come on, jeez.
Yes. Yeah. No, I was actually, I made a joke about that at the Boston Book Festival when I was just there. The first person who was asking questions was saying, asked a very serious question, which of course I made a joke about. And she said, do you think that, Tolkien ever anticipated that his work would become what it has become? And I said, "You mean the inspiration for a Denny's menu?" No, I don't think he envisioned that. But no, I mean, of course, because I was making a serious point that I don't think he imagined it would have the positive impact that it had. But certainly, no, I don't imagine that he ever imagined that it would have this kind of spin-off. Though, in some ways, perhaps so. Thinking. Trish, thinking about the comparisons that you've made in your Mythgard work between the Snow White stuff and
right,
the Hobbit stuff,
right.
That, of course, that model was out there. I mean, we tend to assume that this kind of crass, mercantile commercialization of stories and films like this is a modern phenomenon, and it's not a modern phenomenon.
It's not, no. In fact, one of the points I made was... Yeah, the year that Snow White came out, which was 37, the same year that The Hobbit came out, one of the papers that I found in my research said that the UK was awash in Snow White merchandise. Yeah. That there's no way Tolkien could have avoided it because he had an 8-year-old daughter and a wife who was doing the shopping. Every time they went outside, they had to see something Snow White. So, yeah, he certainly was aware of it.
Right.
Didn't like it, I'm sure. But
right, exactly. And when people, when you look at the things that both J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis went on record about and commenting about Disney,
right.
The word that they kept using, as Trish has pointed out, is vulgar. They talk about
vulgar.
Vulgarity.
Yeah.
And, people will sometimes tend to kind of dismiss that as simply, snootishness on the part of the Oxford Dons looking down at this American businessman. And no doubt that's a big part of it, but I suspect that this is one of the primary things that they're
thinking
of.
Yeah, I think it is.
That basically Walt Disney was shamelessly a businessman who was trying to capitalize on this stuff and maximize his profits. And, he was not first and foremost an artist.
Right.
And that, I think, is what, and therefore, they believed, Lewis and Tolkien believed that, I think, that this impacted, his entire artistic vision, that his films
right.
really show evidence of this and suffer for this. And that,
right.
I think, is what they're identifying as his vulgarity. So, yes, would Tolkien absolutely just, would he be appalled at the vulgarity of the Lord of the Rings stuff that's out now? Yes, I think he would be absolutely appalled and would consider it deeply vulgar. In fact, that's, I think, what we saw in some of Christopher Tolkien's comments
right.
in that Le Monde interview.
I agree.
So apparently the first Denny's opened back in 1950, in the 1950s. What do we think the chances are that Tolkien ever ate at a Denny's?
Zero.
Zero, yes.
Zero.
So,
I think it's zero.
So I just flipped through some of the clips from the Denny's little featurette, unexpected party featurette. And the scenes of the dwarves singing the Chip the Plate song are interesting. At least the ones that I saw don't strike me as the kind of thing that would make it onto a soundtrack. It's not a song. It was kind of more them sort of singing, shouting. It kind of starts pointing at some of the possibilities for how songs might make it into the thing. And as opposed to it being kind of an orchestrated sort of official full song, similar to the Misty Mountain song, it might be something where instead we get the cast singing bits and pieces of the verse of the song, maybe unaccompanied by music or shouting it or reciting it or something, as a pointer or an Easter egg to the song, but not the full actual song in the sense that it would make it onto the soundtrack. I mean, so
right.
the soundtrack.
Well,
listing,
it is on the soundtrack.
Well, the soundtrack listing lists Blunt the Knives. That's no guarantee that the actual singing of the song is in that. That could just be background music that's played during that scene.
I think it's, you know, between Armitage talking about dwarves loving drinking songs, and I think it was Jackson or Boyens talking about, oh, it was Boyens said that dwarves are more like a rugby team than, you know, elves are like posh when they go on their adventures, and dwarves are more like a rugby team. I think they sing it like a drinking song, actually.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be on the soundtrack. So actually, Lord of the Rings features a number of kind of drinking song type songs with like the hobbits dancing on the tables at the Prancing Pony. I'm pretty sure those aren't on the soundtrack, are they? So I'm kind of wondering if maybe there's a possibility that some of the songs might make it into the film in that form, as not a full-blown song, the kind that you would actually orchestrate and accompany with music and then record and include in a soundtrack, but more just sort of very informally having the cast kind of sing and shout together, and filming a bit of it and showing it on screen. So basically what I'm driving
at is... I don't know
what...
I mean...
Just because the other songs aren't listed as... Just because the other songs aren't listed as on the soundtrack doesn't mean that there won't necessarily appear on screen in some form or fashion.
Right. Hey, can I ask...
I could see the Snap Crack one being like a army marching type song, a chant.
Right, right. Can I ask Trish and Matt and others who have gotten to listen to the soundtrack already? Do you recall if the phrase "thumping pole" gets actually sung in the Blunt the Knife song? Pound them up with a thumping pole. Does this happen?
Well, see that now. Here's the Blunt the Knife is not on the standard.
It's not on the standard version.
So and the only piece that I've seen, I have to go back and watch the featurette again. I mean, it might be. I don't know if the Denny's featurette actually does the whole entire song. I may have to go to a Denny's, I guess. Ugh.
No, it doesn't appear to. They have like three or four lines of the song, and it's basically the clip that I saw, and I didn't watch it all the way through closely, but the clip that I saw was basically the dwarves standing, like four or five dwarves standing around Bilbo and basically shouting, "That's what Bilbo Baggins hates," and then raising their glass.
Oh no, well there's another one where they're singing and throwing plates at dwarves who are doing cartwheels and stuff and catching plates on the fly, and I think they're singing during that too. But anyway, so I'll do some research on this and get back to you, Corey. So thumping pole.
Thumping pole. That's my favorite line. Pound them up with a thumping pole is my favorite line in the Chip the Glasses song. I just hope there's a thumping pole involved. That's all. You know, see,
hey!
I don't ask much. Do I ask much?
Not much to ask.
Burn dwarves, thumping pole.
Burn dwarves.
I'm easy to please.
That's right. Easy to please. And also Brass Buttons. Now, one of the things that I wanted to point out, by the way, is we do have a song, a track actually called Brass Buttons. And I remember in an earlier one we talked about, yeah. Now, I actually want to diverge a little bit and get in my latest favorite theme that I've been harassing you guys with.
Yes.
Which is the idea that Radagast is actually the one who finds out that it's Sauron rather than Gandalf. Because remember, we've had an issue with the timing of how the heck is Gandalf going to get to Dol Guldur and then back to Bag End, and where is this going to happen? And it occurred to me that actually this may end up being Radagast's role. That he's the one who goes, "Oh my God, it's Sauron! I must tell the White Council," and heads off on his bunny sled to do so. And it does kind of makes that allows us to do the timing. The Empire magazine article that Dave quoted from twice, both in Riddles in the Dark and in Secrets of the Hobbit, says that the Gandalf at Dol Guldur scenes moved to movie two. And then also my third piece of data is the fact that the Radagast theme from the soundtrack, the one that's actually the Radagast the Brown theme, shows up again in the Hill of Sorcery track.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking that Radagast may be the person who comes to the White Council and says, "Alarm, alarm, alarm, I have now determined that the necromancer is Sauron." So anyway,
well,
that
doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to report that it's Sauron. Maybe he just reports that there's a necromancer dude messing around.
Could. But I mean, what it means is that explains that Gandalf doesn't end up going to Dol Guldur in the first movie. But we still know something's going on.
Still has to. So we'll just invent a completely alternative history of the map, which is possible. I mean, they could certainly do
that. No. Whoa, you're right, actually. Well, it could, yeah, it could be an alternative history of the map. That's right.
Well, it has to be. It has, and I think that's actually entirely likely. Boy, we're getting way off topic now, aren't we? All right, we're
bringing
it back to songs
really quickly. It's my fault.
Really quickly. So we'll say our piece and then we'll go back to songs. But anyway, I would say, I mean, this is something we've been speculating all along, that in the original history of Middle Earth, at this point in the story, when Gandalf is recruiting Bilbo for the journey, they already know it's Sauron, right, Corey?
Right.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah,
Gandalf, and not only do they know, they're already
91 years ago.
The wheels are in motion for assaulting Dol Guldur and trying to drive him out. And so Gandalf just happens to be arranging this journey to the Lonely Mountain at the same time as they're doing as all that. That's not going to work on screen, and it's fairly clear from the character descriptions we've seen and some of the clips that we've seen and whatnot that they want there to be a mystery element to the films of, hey, there's this necromancer guy and there's a Zazog riding around, what's going on, something interesting. And so if that's the case, it can't Gandalf cannot know right at the outset
and I think you guys talked about this in the last episode.
We've hit on this a few times. In fact, that they're actually starting from the tomb of the Nazgul or whatever, and that's going to be like the first thing that the White Council. So I actually think I think Corey, that they probably are rewriting the history
of the map.
Yeah, it seems. Because that's another thing that they mentioned in the article, that the scenes of Gandalf at Dol Guldur probably got pushed to the second film. So it seems like they must be changing that. And I think we kind of speculated all along that probably Radagast was going to be the first person to bring the necromancer storyline to the attention of the White Council, because he lives in Mirkwood. So it seems like it wouldn't be surprising if right around the time that the dwarves and Gandalf and Bilbo arrive in Rivendell, that Radagast the Brown, and just so happens, I guess Saruman's there for some reason too. Radagast the Brown comes riding up with his bunnies and says, "Hey guys, something really bad going down in Mirkwood." So
And actually, in one of the other TV trailers, we've seen yet another very quick scene of the spiders attacking Ross Goble. So it could be that that's another thing that happens that triggers Radagast to look
attacked
into...
and driven out of his home or something.
So. Yeah,
right. Or maybe that's why, because they suspect that he knows, and so we've sent the spiders to shut Radagast up.
The spider enforcement.
Put a contract out on Radagast.
Maybe he wasn't paying his. Maybe he just wasn't paying his protection money.
Exactly. When you think about it from the other direction, I mean, Radagast, like, what else is he going to do? I mean, what are the roles he's supposed to play in this story? Especially since, apparently, I mean, if he's not going to be if he's not going to be a part of the deliberations, if he's not going to be sort of an official part of the White Council, which they've pictorially suggested, then what is he going to do? You know, so that certainly does seem plausible, but I like your evidence, Trish, of the Radagast theme in the Hill of Sorcery.
That's some very strong musical
and evidence.
Very clever how you did that. You brought it back to the music.
How about that? See, that's,
well, okay, so Brianna posted in the...
Oh, Sharon! Sharon says Thumping Pole is in.
Yeah,
Sharon Hoff says she listened and Thumping Pole is in.
Because we do have a full recording of the song, and it is arranged and orchestrated and all that kind of stuff. I posted a link to a Tumblr post where somebody somehow has linked to the full Blunt the Knife song. I posted it in the chat, and it is
excellent.
It
so
is
we will
fully...
probably contribute to shutting down their page.
And Dave Kale has written, "Oh wow, I'm completely wrong. I am going to put that on a T-shirt."
Yes.
Oh wow, I'm completely wrong. That's good.
Thumping Pole is in.
And Billy Zabel pointed out that the Hobbit drinking songs and whatnot from the Lord of the Rings films are in fact on the soundtrack, or at least maybe the extended one. So my theory about maybe the Blunt the Night that has been defeated. I mean, it's still possible. Maybe we'll get or goblins singing Goblin Town-esque type songs that aren't on the soundtrack. But at least Blunt the Knives, we have confirmed, is a real song, much like the Misty Mountains one. So
cool.
And it's pretty, like, it's the song, I don't know if you guys want to attempt to try and listen to it while we do the episode. It makes it hard to listen to what everybody else is saying when you're blasting the song, trust me. But, it is a full blown, like, it's kind of what you would imagine it would sound like, the way it's described in the book. There's instruments. I don't know if we'll see glimpses of dwarves actually playing instruments, but there's definitely instruments. And they, sounds like they kept most of the lyrics, in verse from the book. So, it's a real song.
And this, the scenes that I've seen from this song being sung are, I think this is one thing that I think Tolkien would approve of. I mean, let's leave Denny's out of the equation, but I think the way they've done this, I think is just right in keeping with, you know, what we would have mentally pictured of this anyway. So I think this is going to be a thumbs up scene.
Yeah. Well, good. I mean, I'm excited about it. I think that it's interesting that they're going to have that. I will be interested to see what kind of role it plays in the establishment of the dwarves' character, which seems to be part of what's going on with it. But yeah, I'll be very interested to hear that. We should probably get towards we've been sort of talking, as is our wont, kind of talking around our riddle and mm-hmm. not saying what it is. So we should probably spell out our riddle, which we have formed with the assistance of our live participants here. The original idea that I had for a riddle for today was simply trying to just asking how many of the songs in the first six chapters of the published Hobbit there are six different songs, and that's if you count the goblin song separately. So it is in chapter 4, we get the down to Goblin Town song. Then in chapter 6, we get the 15 birds and 5 fir trees, which is a different song to a different meter and a different tune that the goblins sing. But then right after that, they sing another song, Burn, Burn, Tree and Fern, which is just a reprise of the Goblin Town song. So that's that, you know, a different verse. But counting that separately, we have six. So the two dwarf songs, Chip the Glasses and Crack the Plates, the Far Over the Misty Mountains song, then the Tra-la-la-lolly song, and then the three goblin songs that I just described. Those are the songs that appear in the text of The Hobbit in the first six chapters, which we all are convinced, some of us more or less cheerfully, is going to be the end of the first film. So my initial question had been a much simpler, how many of them do you think are going to be adapted and actually sung in the Hobbit film? And then they went and released the soundtrack and seemed to blow that question out of the water, because now we know, apparently, at least I think all of the evidence certainly seems to suggest, that we'll get two of those, Far Over the Misty Mountains Cold and the Chip the Glasses, or excuse me, Blunt the Knives. And I'm still not. I'm not sure what to do with the change in the title, by the way.
Copyright, maybe. I don't know. No, I wouldn't be.
Copyright.
I mean, I don't know why they would have changed it, but
no, I don't. I don't think, because they have the rights to it.
Yeah.
So no, I think what it's. But it's interesting though. Like, we're going to be talking, instead of talking about glasses, we're going to talk about knives. And I
yeah.
Blunt knives. If there's some kind of sort of, I don't know. Not exactly combat implications, but there's something more threatening with blunt knives. Anyway, I don't know, but I'm still not sure what to do with it. We'll see. But anyway, as I said, it seems like we have that answer. At least, you know, there's no evidence of Tra-la-la-lolly or down to Goblin Town in any of the in any of the soundtrack stuff. So, that's where we were, why we were kind of stuck at the beginning of the episode, because at sort of the last minute, that that idea was kind of scuppered by the soundtrack. So we have adapted it, and we're going to still ask a similar thing. Let me get back to our wording of it here. We're still going to ask, basically, will the six songs from the book be included? You know, be included in how? So we have these are our four options. Option A, as always, is the book answer. which in this case is, contrary to all evidence, all six songs will make their way into the movie. That is, we're going to actually sing all six songs. And there does seem to be evidence against this, but, you know, if you want to insist on the book answer, you still have this, you still have that option. Option B is significant portions of songs will be included, perhaps as dialogue or poetry, but not accompanied by music. So that would be if, for instance, we get them actually chanting the down, down to Goblin Town. I mean, if we do get goblins running around, you know, and saying, you know, clap, snap, the black crack, grip, grab, pinch, nab. If we get them actually chanting that, but that it's not musical, and so therefore doesn't make it onto the soundtrack, then this would count as B, so that we're still getting the text of the songs, but we're not getting. And similarly, if there is, you know, any like elf dialogue that somehow follows the lines of the Tra-la-la-la-la song. you know, I mean, here, like, if we get elves teasing the dwarves for their beards and saying that Bilbo is too fat to fit in keyholes, I would count that as B.
Yes.
Even though that's, you know, that like the too fat to fit in keyholes and stuff, like, those things that I just quoted are not in the song, but still, I mean, it's going in that direction.
They ask them the pointed question, will you be staying or will you be flying?
That's right. If there are any reference to Bannocks, I'm there. So anyway, so option C, so you'll see the options are going in the direction of decreasing use of songs. Option C is most or all of the songs will be referenced on screen, but little of the verse will be included. So this is basically the Easter egg version. You know, so, you know, you might get, for instance, some elf somewhere in some context uttering the word tra-la-la-la-la or something like that, but not in the context of a song.
I would say it'd be more likely if you got a couple of sneering goblins commenting on how they had you know, like, oh, it's like 15 birds and 5 fir trees, eh? Something like that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Or even, you know, having them go over that. Because, I mean, the 15 birds and 5 fir trees song is very gruesome. I mean, the way that they pay attention to the details of how the dwarves are going to be screaming in agony and how their flesh is going to crack and their hair is going to singe and, you know, all of the different senses that they involve in the description of that song, one could easily imagine a dwarf doing a goblin doing a prose version of that, and sort of a gleeful anticipation of the suffering of the dwarves as they're about to burn alive, So B is if we get a fuller version of it. C is just like brief references, you know, like I said, that kind of Easter egg thing. I mean, the reference to 15 birds and 5 fir trees, if it happens like, you know, Dave was just describing and as Sharon was suggesting earlier in our discussion and before the show, if we get a line like that, then that's basically like an Easter egg. Nobody but devoted fans of the book are going to get anything out of that, are going to understand the significance of that at all. So that would be C. And then option D is the only book songs included will be the two listed in the published soundtrack. So that is, there really won't be any trace of, you know, for this case, there won't be any trace of the Tra-la-la-la-la song. There won't be any trace of the Goblin Town song or the 15 Birds and 5 Fir Trees. It's just, you know, we're going to get those two dwarf songs, and then that's it as far as the book songs are concerned. I will add that, you know, we don't have involved in this prediction any other, you know, music or things like it's, right. You know, it's not about any additions or references to Lord of the Rings songs or anything like that. Just
or
the
Rankin Bass
songs.
Songs.
The published Hobbit. What?
Or Rankin Bass
songs.
Songs.
Exactly. Yeah. If somebody breaks into a refrain from Glenn Yarborough's Ballad of the Hobbit, you know, that will not count.
Or Leonard Nimoy songs.
Yeah, that I would give them props for, you know, if in fact, it would be something like if I were Howard Shore, which everybody should be glad I'm not, it would, like, I would be totally tempted to do, to, like, to have some, like, you know, homage to the Ballad of Bilbo Baggins at some point in some piece of background music.
I'm holding out for a full music video cast rendition of that song, including With the lead sung by Benedict Cumberbatch in full necromancer costume.
Oh, they should. They should.
Yeah. Now that sounds plausible. That sounds plausible.
They should have used that instead of Neil Finn's song for over the credits at the end. That would have been appropriate.
Yes, I agree. Maybe that will be the post-credits spoiler, like surprise.
Surprise.
Benedict Cumberbatch, and then the actors dressed up as Azog and Bulk dancing a jig and singing this song.
What, the Ballad of Bilbo Baggins?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I'm not holding my breath for that, but
So really pleased. I'm actually really happy with this question. I think this is a really good
question.
I
know. For as much as trouble we had coming up with it, I think this came out actually pretty good.
I think three of the four answers are all very plausible.
Yes, I think so too. Oh, wait, we have to vote now. Shoot.
I know.
Okay, what do I think?
I was thinking I might wait until the digest, but...
Yeah. No, you've been talking in this episode, so you have
to
you're obligated to vote. So,
I know.
And it's not changed by the fact that I just totally made up that rule. It's now officially the rule. So.
And Dave agreed, so there you go.
Okay,
then it's really official.
I will go first. And I'm going to say C, Easter egg. I think that they are going to make references to it. I would expect something along the lines of the 15 birds and 5 fir trees reference. You know, if not that, then something like it. I could even imagine them doing something to do some kind of a tra-la-la-la-la Easter egg, if only because, although you know, that song does not generally succeed with Hobbit book fans, and so therefore is unlikely to be adapted in the film, although that's true, it is also a very memorable moment in the book, and something that would, I think, be a very effective Easter egg, you know, given the kind of effect that Easter eggs are designed to have.
Absolutely.
So wait. On that note, just a clarification question, Corey. What would you do if on their way into Rivendell, the dwarves pass by elves doing a Lord of the Rings style Gregorian chant song in Elvish, and it turns out that the translation of that into English is the words of Tra-la-la-la-li?
That would totally be C, no question.
that's like
a hardcore Easter egg right there. Yeah, if they sing portions of Tra-la-la-la-li translated into Quenya
in any language, yeah.
absolutely. That's exactly a C answer there.
That would be amazing. Like them singing a very serious sort of meditative, like Elvish song, and then subtitles saying, "Where are you going? With beards all a wagging."
No knowing, no knowing. What brings Mr. Baggins? Yes.
Oh, well, I can only hope.
Yeah.
That would be great.
See, this is exactly this. The reason why the films would suck so much if I made them, like if you and I made them, Dave, is that we would pour all of our time and effort into doing things like this, and you know, neglect all the basic things of film storytelling and stuff. We would just be packing it with the most hilarious Easter eggs possible.
Hey, Sarah brings up a question that I actually had thought of too, and I think Dave is usually really good at this. Do you think the judges will have a hard time coming up with, and of course Sarah's saying this because I think she's one of the judges, between
yes.
B and C, yes, between
well, I mean,
B and I C, think, I mean, how would you?
Right, that is a bit of a judgment call. I would say, let's see, for this, the difference really lies in whether or not the songs are going to be so A is the songs are incorporated as songs as they are, which seems unlikely. B, I feel like I have to give that disclaimer when we talk about A. B is basically the songs are still incorporated, just not as sung. You know, so they're being incorporated in some other way. So in order for the answer to be B, it would have to be like, you know, so if a goblin just says, "Oh, 15 birds and 5 fir trees," that's an Easter egg thing. It's not an incorporation
of
song.
That's C.
You'd have to have at least
right.
two or three lines of it
yes.
for it really to be incorporated. I mean, so like, if we get goblins marching through the tunnels, You know, and chanting to, you know, to each other without music, chanting, you know, grip, grab, pinch, nab, and down, down to Goblin Town we go. I mean, if we get that, then that's B.
That's B. That's B. Yeah.
Whereas
C would
if
C would be
like
the kind of
C
thing.
A C version of Goblin. Go ahead, Dave. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, C would be basically one line from a character that causes Tolkien fans to look at each other and say, "Oh, hey, they just did a reference to the song."
Right, but which people who don't know the books wouldn't pick up on at all.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's my question.
B is the kind of thing where it's going to be fairly noticeable because they verbatim recite lines from the song or close
to. Okay, so what if we have what Corey just said, you know, which is we have the goblins chanting as they march, and we have some Easter eggs?
Then it's B.
Then it's B.
Okay. So B supersedes C. Okay.
Yes, the premise of C is that they will only be used as Easter eggs.
Yep.
Okay, so I'm going to put will only be referenced.
Yes.
On screen,
any reference to the difference between D and C is in D there's not even references. We're getting the two songs and it's interesting that both the songs occur at the unexpected party, and then so what happens in D is essentially we get some lighthearted singing at the beginning, and so that Peter Jackson, the filmmakers, can say, "See, we kept the songs. It's got that same feel." And then as soon as they leave Bag End, it turns into a Lord of the Rings film. No more singing,
right?
Or songs or references or anything like that. C is basically. Right. They make a good solid effort to make us Tolkien fans happy by tossing in a reference to birds and trees and something, you know, an elf making a comment about the dwarves' beards or asking them whether they'll be staying or leaving soon, stuff like that.
Right.
B is like literally the songs, the text of the songs is incorporated into the script somehow.
Right.
Got it. Okay.
And then A is Rankin Bass.
Which is not likely. Okay.
Yep.
So I rewrote C to say most or all of the songs will be referenced on screen with only a passing reference or a snippet of verse.
That's right.
Yep.
Okay. So that should help. That should help the judges.
So let's see.
Okay.
Let's look at the songs.
So what do you guys think? You guys have to go on record now.
We know,
Dave asked.
We know one and two are definitely in, so that leaves us with Goblin songs and the Tra-la-la-lally song. Yeah.
Yep, that's not, really what we're talking
they're
about.
They're not used. They're not incorporating that into the film. C.
Boy, I sure would like to see that. That Goblin Town song, you know, turn into a marching chant, but that would be B.
Yeah.
But I think it's probably more likely to be C. So I think we're going to have unanimity here.
Okay. Now,
I'm going to be really disappointed if they don't give us some Easter eggs with regard to the songs. I mean, if it turns out to be D, I'm going to be really pissed.
Yeah. I think that's what I would be most surprised by, really. I would be most surprised.
If it was just D, yeah.
Yeah, if they just ignore it entirely. And the main reason that I say that is that so far I have been so impressed with how thoughtful they have been. I mean, they have been, it strikes me anyway, very dutiful in their reading of the text. That doesn't mean that they're incorporating everything. It doesn't mean that they're making the decision to you know, involve everything from the published book. But they're not just ignoring stuff. You know, they're not just kind of leaving it behind and going off entirely on their own. I've been able to see rationale for, you know, most everything that they have done. So I would be surprised if they just don't go there at all. That's just kind of my own hunch. I think that maybe D is a little bit more likely than A, but I certainly think, you know, B would be my second choice, certainly.
It does seem James Pace made a comment which I agree with, which is it does seem odd that you would have two songs right at the beginning and then nothing the rest of the movie.
Yep.
It seems it's striking me as a very bizarre transition, but given what we've seen of the published track list, as well as the material they have to work with, namely some thoroughly non-serious songs like Tra-La-La-Lally and 15 Birds and whatnot, it's really hard to see those songs fitting well in any substantial way with a Lord of the Rings epic style film. So
yeah, though the one thing I will say is you know, a year ago I might have said the same about Chip the Glasses and Crack the Plates, but
that's true.
But yeah, I mean, it is certainly, and you know, and certainly there was never much hope for the Tra-La-La-Lally song. I was holding out some hope for the Goblin Town song.
Yes,
certainly.
I think the Goblin Town song is the most, seems like the most likely one. It's kind of easy to imagine turning that into kind of a marching song or parts of it. Having like the, as they're marching the dwarves down to Goblin Town, having like the goblins kind of, you know, walking along in the darkness and then trying to antagonize their prisoners by leaping out and yelling, shouting snap and crack and things like that. Now they sound like the guy, the Rice Krispie guys.
Rice Krispies.
Snap, crackle, pop.
But you can do swish, smack, and whip.
Yes,
crack,
yes, you know, that's right.
Pound, so, pound, far underground. You know, there are definitely lines that could
that
be.
That seems like the most likely possibility, in my opinion. But I don't know. It's really
and I'm
hard
happy
to
report that a number of our listeners are going with B, so they're not swayed by our unanimity, which I think is a good thing.
Definitely.
Oh, good. Good.
There's precedence for drinking, eating songs in Lord of the Rings. Sharon says. Does that mean maybe we'll get 15 birds? Because that's kind of a cooking song.
It's kind of a pre-eating song.
Yes.
Yeah. True.
So let's see. So we all pick C. Let's see. Billy says B.
Sarah's
Sharon,
a B.
Not,
Sharon's a B.
B.
Brianna's with us, C.
Yeah.
And Billy actually changed his mind. He's very ambivalent.
Are you reading Sarah's? Sarah's making a caveat as a judge.
right.
So, yeah, interesting.
Oh, Sharon hasn't gone with B yet. Okay. So, yeah, so B and C seems to be, those are the two, which I suppose not surprising would be the two most popular ones.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree.
So
those are definitely the most likely.
So I have two last things that I want to that are slightly off topic that I want to cover before we go. One is a question from Yana that I think is an interesting one, which is looking at the soundtrack list, and actually let me scan it really fast. Nothing on here looks like a prologue soundtrack.
When I listen, I think I said this to Corey.
Yes.
When I listened to the My Dear Frodo track, I noticed this in particular because when I thought My Dear Frodo, I was expecting it to be more Hobbit themed, and I think there is a little bit of Hobbit theme in it, but there's also some very deep themes in that My Dear Frodo track, and what that led me to think is that the prologue music may be part of that track.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yes, there have been a couple people.
So Sauron, so Brianna pointed out, she specifically named it. She said Sauron's melodic themes are all over the soundtrack. She says Gandalf's In Danger theme, which plays at the beginning of Two Towers when he's fighting the Balrog, presumably the flashback there, are actually play during Dear Frodo. So maybe that's where.
Ah, okay.
Possibly. I don't know. What were you saying, Corey?
No, I was just going to say that several people who have posted on either the Riddles in the Dark page or the Tolkien Professor Facebook page have been basically taking great hope for our prospects of the Battle of Azan-ul-Bazar from the soundtrack. There have been some, you know, people who have definitely drawn some optimistic Azan-ul-Bazar conclusions from the soundtrack so far.
Count Father Roderick in that group. That's what he told me last week. I remain skeptical.
Yeah.
There are two bonus tracks titled Erebor and the Dwarf Lords, which look interesting and promising for prologue type material.
Yeah, that's right. I had thought about that, that might be...
What could that possibly be other than a history lesson?
Yeah.
Yeah, it certainly... Yeah,
and Erebor could be when Smaug destroys it.
Thorin or something, but yeah.
Yep.
No, that does seem possible. Can I also say that Brianna's comment just now, and Trish, some of the stuff that you've been talking about too, I really love the analysis of the soundtrack based upon the identifiable themes. That I think is it's just a really cool piece of analysis. I just really enjoy that because movie soundtracks do work really well that way.
Brianna and I are happy to come be guests at your Story of the Hobbit course next semester.
We'll have to have a whole other segment on.
I know. Oh yeah,
Brianna.
Really,
Brianna, write an extended blog post and we'll link to it.
Yeah, do please.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. It's very cool. So
just
yeah.
Throw
so,
away your entire weekend analyzing the soundtrack, and we'll link to it.
Yeah, excellent.
Now,
apparently,
Brianna's
already
you had another
written this blog post.
You had another off-topic question.
Yes,
I have
did.
An off-topic question as well.
Yes. I did, which I want to do for our good friend Corey Matt Shaw. Strongly requested that we messaged Trish and I on Facebook and asked us, please talk about this. The Lego Goblin Scribe.
That was mine. So we've got the same question. Yes.
Okay. Good. Yes. Okay. Goblin Scribe. So the objection seems to be primarily to having there be a scribe among the goblins at all.
I don't know that there's an objection. I just know Matt. I think in previous Silmarillion seminars and other places has multiple times floated the theory of the goblins having a rich and deep oral history. and racial memory of many wrongs done to them by the elves throughout the past, yada yada yada, and so he saw this and he was like, aha, see, so.
he also
teed up the idea of maybe there's some kind of kangaroo court that they have in Goblin Town, you know, where there's the scribe actually, you know, is like the court recorder or something.
So he's actually a goblin stenographer.
Right.
Yeah, that's good. he's taking the minutes, you know. Well, of course, I was going to say, Dave, that The Hobbit provides us the very best evidence that we have to support Matt's claim about goblin culture in the fact that they recognize Glamdring and Orcrist when they see them, where presumably it's been thousands of years since those weapons were used against the goblins. And the fact that the goblins know them and recognize them and know their name, not just have names of their own for them, but know the names that the elves gave them, because Beater and Biter, what the goblins call them, are clearly derived from the meanings of the elvish names. You know, goblin cleaver is called Biter, and foe hammer is called Beater. So even the names that they have reflect an actual knowledge of the elven names of the swords. The fact that the goblins recognize the swords is fairly clear evidence that they must have an oral history of those things, unless the great goblin is himself thousands of years old, which is possible in one way that Tolkien was thinking about the great goblin and about orc chieftains in his later writings. But anyway, we don't have to get into all that right now. So the goblin scribe. I think that is interesting. The idea of them having a scribe, even if they did have a rich culture, one would still kind of expect it to be an oral culture rather than a written culture. That is the one thing that seems to me most puzzling. Is the idea that they actually have written records, that the orcs are in fact literate. I'm trying to think if we have any...
Do you think maybe scribe is like some kind of insider joke?
It's actually a torturer or something?
Yes. It's a ukulele.
Well, he actually has. I mean, in the Lego thing, he's actually got. I mean, he's actually like got some like a tablet that, you know, and I guess a writing utensil. I mean, and the thing I thought of is why would Lego include that in the toy set if there wasn't some reference to that in the film? I mean, I was scratching my head over it.
Again, maybe those are tools of torture.
Yes, exactly. Yes, let's call in the scribe to handle this one. Yeah.
He's going to write all over you.
Exactly right. Yes. I don't know. I mean, I will be interested to see if there is, in fact, a scribe in the movie somewhere, which, again, the fact that he's in a Lego set doesn't, to me, absolutely prove.
But, no, you're right.
But if there is, you know, what kind of glimpses of orc culture we're going to get. I mean, it's one of the big questions, really, that I think the whole Misty Mountain sequence raises, especially since, as we've discussed before, we all kind of expect their time in Goblin Town to be quite expanded from what it is in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the one time where we're really given the opportunity in The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings, essentially, to see the homes of goblins. I mean, the closest we get otherwise is Frodo and Sam's trip through Mordor, but those are only army camps. We don't actually see where they live. So actually getting to see glimpses of the home life of orcs, that is conceivable in this context, both when they're being captured and even more so when they're escaping. I mean, you've got to imagine it's quite possible that when, you know, Gandalf and the dwarves are fleeing, that they're going to end up blundering through, you know, places the goblins didn't expect them to go. You know, we could have, I'm not saying I'm predicting this will happen, but it is conceivable that we could get them, you know, like tromping through goblin living rooms and daycare centers and stuff like that. So, you know, who knows? But it does give, if it turns
daycare
out,
centers.
Yeah, exactly. If it turns out that Peter Jackson and company are interested to depict goblin culture, you know, if they do want to show a kind of here's the other side of the curtain thing, however they decide to take that, they would have the opportunity to do it. So, you know, it may be that the goblin scribe is a kind of glimpse at, you know, some idea of an actual alternate culture that the goblins have.
The other interesting thing, and actually this is part of the Lego set too, but I know it's also been written as far as goblin culture in one of the publications, is, you know, they do talk about the goblins being scavengers. The interesting part is the Goblin Town apparently is made up of literally, you know, like scavenged doors and skeleton pieces. And I mean, so they use, like, I think, like, the bridge in the Lego set, I think the bridge is actually made, you know, you could identify like doors and other kind of, you know, pieces that would have maybe been salvaged from a building or something. So that's, I think that whole set is going to be really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Good. Well, okay. I think we should probably, I've got to go here pretty soon.
Yep.
One last thing I wanted to say.
I don't want to disappoint everybody that we're ending so early.
I know. It's only been like 2 hours. What are we doing? But anyway, yeah, no, I do have to run, but I did want to give a little update about our Mythmoot gathering for the watching of the film and the discussion thereof in December 15th and 16th in Baltimore. And we have had a lot of people register. I did want to say that seats are kind of going fast at this point. There has been a steady stream of registration. We have over 70 people attending now. And
wow.
There are still, we're about two-thirds of the way, a little bit more than two-thirds of the way sold out. So if you are interested in coming and haven't gotten your ticket yet, sooner is probably better than later, because we really do have a cap. Once we sell out, we only have the one room available to us at the hotel, and it only fits so many people. So we're not going to be able to sell other tickets beyond our number. So so if you're thinking about coming, do move on it sooner rather than later. We had some exciting news since our last episode. where Peter Beagle, the author of The Last Unicorn and the screenwriter for the Bakshi Lord of the Rings film interpretation, is going to be coming. He's flying out from California for the event, so he's going to be there. Well, he will take part in the panel discussion of the film. He's done a lot of stuff with films, of course. Not only did he do work on the Lord of the Rings film with Ralph Bakshi, but he also, of course, worked on the film adaptation of The Last Unicorn. And film is a world that he's worked in a lot, so I know he's really interested to see. You know, he's a big fan of Jackson's Lord of the Rings.
And he is joining us to watch the movie the thing. So he will be actually in the theater with us.
An opportunity to hold someone responsible for the Ralph Bakshi adaptation.
Oh, God. I was going to say, let's be nice to him about this.
No, I will say with that, I am not a fan of the Ralph Bakshi films, but I will say Peter's part in it, I find entirely respectable. I think that Peter Beagle can hold his
head
high when it comes to the Ralph Bakshi stuff, because the screenplay that he wrote he did as admirable a job as you could to use as much as possible of Tolkien's actual dialogue. You know, the thing that I always say about films, how you can't just have the book put on screen. Well, by golly, Beagle did his best to actually make that happen. You know, take the text and the dialogue of the book and put it up on screen. Whatever you think about Bakshi's rather curious visual interpretation of the works, and whatever you might think of some of the actors' performances, I don't know who plays Sam, but I hold a personal grudge against whoever is the dude who played Sam in the Bakshi version. So whatever you might think about this other stuff, I think the screenplay is extremely well done and very interesting and entirely respectable. So I think that Peter Beagle's part in it is in my eyes anyway, the best part of the whole film. Anyway, so Peter is going to be coming. And of course, you know, as many of you know, I'm a big fan of The Last Unicorn. I think it's one of the greatest works of fantasy written in the 20th century. I mean, it is certainly in my eyes in absolutely the top echelon of post-Tolkien fantasy. The Last Unicorn is just one of the classics, I think, of the fantasy genre.
Daniel Helen says, interestingly, it premiered 34 years ago today. Daniel, you're talking about the Bakshi film or The Last Unicorn?
Interesting. I didn't know we had an
34 years ago
today. So Peter is coming to join us. So we will have Peter Beagle there, and he will take part in our. We'll have some, you know, we'll have the opportunity to do some Q&A and everything with him, and part of our,
That's
he'll be coming to the banquet, and he'll be coming to the film and everything. So anyway, so that's where we're very excited to welcome Peter. Of course, he'll be signing books, and he will even have. Okay, are you ready for this? He still has some of the first edition DVDs of the Lord of the Rings, of the Bakshi Lord of the Rings film, which he's going to have available, which he will autograph. So, yes.
Oh, wow.
That's right. He's going to be selling stuff at the back of the room. That's right.
Yeah. So he's gonna have books and stuff, and he'll be doing signings and everything. So that'll be a lot of fun. So anyway, so the Mythmoot preparations carry on apace. It's going to be a lot of fun. As I said, we already have. I think our total guest list is up to about 80 now. So we still have some seats left, but not all that many. But it's going to be a big event, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So I definitely invite you all to look into that. You'll find a link to it if you go to the Mythgard homepage, mythgard.org. There's a little link to it over on the right-hand side, a little box linking to the Mythmoot. That's the easiest place you can find all the information and the registration information to get your tickets. So
cool.
Billy's asking where it's going to be next year. I suspect, don't you, Corey, we're probably going to do same geographical location.
Probably, yeah. We'll see. It's conceivable that it might change. I might. I'm still kind of tempted to keep it. It probably won't move west, which Billy, I suspect, is what you're hoping for. Mostly because we actually have several people, at least three, possibly four, who are flying over from Europe to attend the Mythmoot. And if we put it in California, it makes it pretty much impossible for Europeans to be able to come over. The East Coast, at least, is equally inconvenient for people on the West Coast and people from Europe. So for that reason, you know, thinking about
and probably most importantly, moving it makes it inconvenient for you. And
right. Corey, that's
you
right.
are the you are the you are the linchpin and anchor of this thing, and moving it elsewhere right. makes it much more likely to fail.
Yeah, well, it is harder. So, and for that reason, it'll probably stay on the East Coast. But you know, will it be in Baltimore? Not necessarily. As Trish says, probably, but not absolutely. Are we definitely doing it next year? Yeah, I certainly want to do it next year. I mean, I would definitely like to. You know, my plan is to do. I want to do a big Mythgard conference. That is a big international Tolkien academic academic and fan conference, like the Tolkien Society's Return of the Ring conference that happened this past summer.
Maybe we
I
should
want to do one of those. But
maybe
that's
we
not
should plan
be for
a
long.
Maybe we should plan another like modest movie thing for next year, and then for the following summer when the third film comes out, go crazy and do a conference.
Yeah, there you
well,
go.
Well, that was my thought. I think I'm actually going to push it to the year after that because I want to be able. What I would really like is to be able to have some of the film people attend.
Oh, I see.
Oh,
that makes
and
sense.
Probably going to be involved in stuff. Whereas a year later. Right. So if we do it in the summer of 2015, then right. we might even be able to get people like you know Peter Jackson or Philippa Boyens or Richard Taylor to attend the conference,
right.
which is what I would
right.
really like. So
now Brent was asking, will it be live or just podcasted? I am working on that, Brent. We're definitely going to be videoing pieces of it. So there will at least be, you know, something come out after. Not sure about live streaming yet, but we're working on that.
Yeah, that may well be possible. But at the very least, we will be recording a bunch of it and we can certainly audio stream quite a bit of it. So.
And Brent's score sheet that he and I are working on, the one we're going to be able to provide everybody to take of all the riddles and conundrums, that Brent, I want you to know that will be figuring largely in Mythmoot. So you will be there in spirit, if nothing else.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Okay. So, well, I think I should let everybody go now.
So,
but thanks for your help in working out our riddle today.
One last thing, actually.
Yeah. Okay, sure.
So Trish and I are going to try to do a digest next week.
Yay!
And then we've got basically two weeks until the film comes out. I guess three from next week. So the premiere is in New Zealand on November 28th, which is in like 10 days, I think, 13 days. So I guess 2 weeks, basically. So we may try to do what we'll talk, Corey and Trish and I'll talk it over and figure out our schedule for upcoming episodes. But we might try to do something right around maybe right after the premiere, because I'm sure despite their best efforts, some information will leak out. So.
Yeah, so I think we'll probably be able to. I think we'll do one more episode before that. Mm-hmm. And then we can do another episode. Then there will still be one more episode that will happen prior to
Oh, well, you know, actually, and we were talking about the next I'm echoing. I can hear myself. Sorry. We were talking about the next episode, Corey, being one that the listeners kind of vote on what will be the topic.
Yes. I would like to do that. So people who are listening, do look out for that. We will have certainly on the Riddles in the Dark Facebook page an opportunity for you guys to vote on what to nominate
right.
topics for our next episode. If there are things that we haven't talked about that you've been hoping we would, that we haven't gotten to yet, do let us know what you'd like to hear us talk about, and we could even address several of them.
Yeah. So I'll put a poll question up that allows folks to enter in their own stuff.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, just type in what you want, and then people can vote on it.
Yeah, excellent. So we will definitely be looking forward to that. So they can be small things. We can do a bunch of small things. We can do a couple bigger topics, whatever you guys want us to talk about. So yes, thanks for mentioning that, Trish, because that's what we were thinking about for our next episode.
Right.
So okay.
And then and then just one other thing. The one right before, so December 11th is a Tuesday, but it might sometime that week would be the one right before the movie comes out. And what I had teed up for that was for us to go through all of the riddles and conundrum, clarify anything that needs to be clarified. You know, just kind of do a big review.
Yeah, that would probably. And that's when we can also then, in the context of that, talk about. Things that have leaked out of New Zealand.
right.
Well. So, okay, good, excellent. Very good. Well, then I should let everybody go then. But thanks for joining us, everybody. And we will speak to you guys again soon in a couple weeks. So thanks for listening, and Godspeed.
Smash the bottles and burn the corks. Tip the glasses and crack the plates. That's what Bilbo Baggins hates. Cut the cloth, trail the fat. Leave the bones on the bedroom mat. Pour the milk on the pantry floor. Splash the wine on every door. Dump the crotch in a boiling bowl. Pound them up with a thumping pole. And when you're finished, they pay a hole.